Thank you. Good morning. Welcome. I'm glad to see all of you here who braved the tsunami outside. I hope you had a good time last night. I thought it was a wonderful evening. And I want to thank former Congressman Steve Gunderson, who, like me, has found life after politics, for moderating the coming panel. And those of you who braved the weather to come here will not be sorry. This is there is no more impressive panel that we've had in terms of the lives that the panelists have lived and the work they're doing now, and it's profoundly important. And all I want to say about this is they're going to talk about rural development and what it means to the economy. I just want to say one thing about the current economic problems in America and around the world. The wealthy countries must not learn the wrong lesson. There is, usually when something like this happens, all we do is look inward and try to fix the mechanics of the financial system. Should that have been done? Should there be more oversight and regulation? Absolutely. But don't learn the wrong lesson here. The people who have these microcredit operations who are investing in poor people around the world where there was no market and you create one because they're smart people, they're not the cause of any of these financial problems. They're all making money in the old-fashioned way with a real economy based on real people doing real things for a real rate of return. So So for those of you that took the trouble to come here through this weather today, you're in for a treat. They're wonderful people. They have lived magnificent lives. And when you leave here, if you want to support what they're doing, tell everybody you can, scream from the rooftops, do not learn the wrong lesson from our current problem. Fix the current problem, but don't leave it with the wrong lesson. This is an opportunity, not a problem, that we're about to talk about. Okay, we have a couple of commitments here, and then we'll get on with the program. The first, I want to invite for the stage Elias Boussab, the Executive Vice President of the American University in Dubai. Elias, come on. I suppose I should be bound to make full disclosure here. This gentleman is a good friend of mine. I have had the honor of being his commencement speaker and helping him to recruit American students to go there and study so that we will solve some of the cultural divides between the United States and the Muslim world. And I think I wish all of you could see a commencement there with students from all over the world, Muslim students, who practice their faith in different ways and manifest it in different ways, even at the commencement exercise. It's an amazing thing. But he has made a commitment to create scholarships for students from the Middle East to attend their school for communication, the Mohammed bin Rashid School for Communications. This will bring students, 400 of them from across the region, working with the USC's Annenberg School for Communications. His school for communication will train students to become more objective, fair, and responsible in their use of the media, giving rise to a new generation of media specialists in the Arab world and helping to improve relations between East and West. Currently, there are more than, listen to this, 300 satellite television stations on the air in the Middle East. Arabic ranks in the top 5 spoken languages in the world, and estimates suggest that over 400 million people now speak Arabic, making Arabic media all the more important. If you go to some European countries today, there are more Arabic television channels in the hotel rooms than there are English. It's very, very interesting. And the Middle East is television crazy. They really know what they're doing in terms of using this media for political as well as for enlightenment purposes. And so the potential of this commitment to change the future of the region in a positive way is quite staggering. It's worth $26 million over 4 years, and I am very grateful to to my friend for doing this. Thank you very much. Here, let me just give you this. I would now like to invite to the stage Dina Powell, the Director of Global Corporate Engagement for Goldman Sachs, Milan Verveer, the co-founder, chair, and CEO of Vital Voices Global Partnership, Andres Pastrana, member of the Board of Directors of the Club of Madrid and former President of Colombia. I'm a member of the Club of Madrid. That's an interesting organization that we're about to have our meeting, actually, in Europe, and work on climate change, but it's guys like me that used to have power and don't anymore, and we're all dressed up, and we have to find some place to go. And increasingly, thanks to the Club of Madrid, we are all being put to more useful purposes. So I'm grateful. This is Kodu Da, the Executive Director of the Forum for African Women and Educationalists, Peter Banky Bankole, General Manager of Enterprise Development Services, Pan-African University, Bernardo Guillamon, advisor to the Office of Outreach and Partnerships of the Inter-American Development Bank. Goldman Sachs, Vital Voices, Inter-American Development Bank, World Bank Group, ExxonMobil, the Club of Madrid, have made a $28 million commitment to empower women in developing countries with business education. As part of their previous 10,000 women commitment, Goldman Sachs is making a new promise to do the following things: to provide 300 Liberian women with a business education, to strengthen the $30 million Liberian Enterprise Development Company Fund announced at CGI in 2006. That's a good thing. We worked hard on that, and it's finding successful outlets there. They will provide the Forum for African Women Educationalists with scholarship for 100 African women to receive a business education at programs like the Enterprise Development Services at Pan-African University in Nigeria. Finally, Goldman and its partners will provide funding to support educational opportunities for women in Latin America. The Inter-American Development Bank will develop a gender and diversity fund to enhance gender equality in its programs. And Vital Voices, the World Bank, and ExxonMobil will support a regional summit training program for emerging women leaders. Finally, the Club of Madrid will launch a training program to strengthen women's political leadership. Yeah, we don't like it, all of us retired people, when there are too few women at the meetings. That's good. This is a really good deal. Let me say to all of you, we talked about this earlier at one of our earlier meetings, and there was a lot of applause at the beginning of this when I said that the only proven way to deal with the impact that the population explosion of the world was going to have on the global warming crisis was to put all the girls of the world in school and give all the women access to the labor market and capital to start businesses. It's one thing to clap about it, another to set in motion a process that actually might produce such results. And that's what has been done here today. I think this is a very good commitment, and I thank them. Let's give them a hand.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. CEO, Swiss Reinsurance Company, Jacques Agran. Founder, Green Belt Movement, Kenya, Wangari Maathai. President and CEO, First Nations Owista Corporation, Elsie Meeks. Pastor Saddleback Church, Rick Warren. Founder and Managing Director, Grameen Bank, Mohammed Yunus. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our moderator, President and CEO, Council on Foundations, Steve Gunderson.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. We've talked about a lot of things over the last couple of days, and now we want to switch that focus just a bit to talk to a topic that might not be totally familiar with all of you, and that is philanthropy in rural areas. Yesterday afternoon, you might have recalled that Judith Roden from the Rockefeller Foundation, when she was here, she shared with us that 700 million poor people live on less than $1 a day. Yesterday morning, I was at the United Nations, and the Chancellor of Austria pointed out that three-fourths of the poor worldwide live in rural areas and earn their living from agriculture. I love to talk about rural philanthropy because, as Susan Beresford, the former president and CEO of the Ford Foundation, used to say, if you want real innovation, go to the rural areas. They've got to do it. And we will take their ideas and their good works, and we will replicate them all across the world. So we have an amazing panel here. You've just met them. And we're going to spend a few minutes now trying to look at this whole issue. But I'm going to start this out with a little bit of a different focus, because the other night at the reception, I was talking to our dear friend Elsie Meeks, and she said she felt a little bit out of place at the Clinton Global Initiative. She said, you know, I think I am the only Native American organization here. Elsie, how do we explain to all of these wonderful people in the crowd that Native American philanthropy is a good place to put your philanthropic resources?
Well, yes, as Steve said, I was talking about that. And, you know, I'm from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, and I've worked there for so many years and now working with tribes all over the country. And the poverty on these reservations they've been compared to third world country. And so to come here and to not have any focus on that has really been disquieting. But this is the thing that the message I really want to take is, we've been handed a bunch of poor policies by the federal government, most Native American tribes. But there is opportunity there now. I mean, the private sector is starting to get a little bit of a start, and it's mostly through community development financial institutions. And, you know, we have just decided as tribes, and I can't speak for every tribal member or every tribe, but here's the message, is whatever paths we take, us as tribal leaders, us as community developers, has to be a path that leads people to wealth creation, which seems like a really odd thing to say when you have people that are very dependent and very poor, as a lot of the countries are represented here, to really say, let's not just think about meeting immediate needs. I mean, that has to be done too. But let's get our eye on this ball of wealth creation for each person.
Great. Wangari Maathai, one of the things we have talked about for the last 2 days is the environment and philanthropy. You've taken that to that next generation, environment, philanthropy, and rural areas. How do we better invest philanthropic dollars in the green movement and similar movements all over the world?
Well, first let me say how grateful I am to be here and to be part of the CGI and President Clinton's vision for the world. And I think that my background is biological sciences, and I went to school in this wonderful country, and I went back home, and I wanted to make a contribution in the University of Nairobi. I wanted to really be a teacher in the University of Nairobi, and I don't know how I moved out of there to the rural areas, but I eventually found out that no matter what we do at the global level, even at the national level, that it is extremely important that we do not leave or lose link with the grassroots. because the majority of the people on this planet are at the grassroots level. And the majority of people that we have mentioned here, when we mention poverty, we are thinking about a large number of people at the grassroots level. Now, those people are most dependent on primary natural resources. We are talking land, soil, water, forests. Yet we haven't mentioned many of those issues except in terms of deficiency, that we don't have water, land is desertifying. But we need to think of how we can sustainably manage these primary resources that all of us depend on. But the people at the grassroots are the ones that are most directly dependent on them. And even on issues of climate change, even as we speak of what is going to happen, it's already happening to a large number of people. They are experiencing lack of water, they are experiencing drying rivers, and most of all, they are worried because their forests are disappearing, and that is partly why I think that the environment is extremely important. At the United Nations, you will know that they were talking about Millennium Development Goals. For me, the Millennium Development Goal number 7, which is the environment, sustainability of the environment, is the most important because it should be number 1, not poverty. Because if you destroy the environment, all the other Millennium Development Goals cannot be achieved.
Let's talk development for just a second. And to your left, Jacques is quite engaged in markets, markets in rural areas. Most people think that's an oxymoron. Can we do rural development with markets?
Well, the first thing I would start by saying that there is hardly a circumstance which would be more humbling than to be on this panel for a simple spokesperson of a for-profit company. So I'm extremely honored and certainly flattered to be here. The simple statement that I can bring is, and I think that Elsie touched on it already, is that actually commercial enterprise and commercial solutions are at the core of sustainable solutions for the problems on hand. We can develop commercially viable solutions to offer, in our case, risk covers to rural areas which are otherwise totally inaccessible. And thus we can offer some contributions to avoiding the worst of the poverty traps which do exist. I think that no one is better placed than Professor Yunus in that field to speak about it, because it's exactly what Grameen Bank has been developing over the decades, that at a modest level, that's what we also have learned to do. And we can, thanks to technology, offer solutions which actually work commercially for the rural area.
You know, one of the things we Americans in the audience are guilty of is we always think we're going to take our good idea someplace else. Mohammed, you've taken your good idea and brought it here. What prompted you to bring that idea to, of all places, rural America?
Well, first time I didn't bring it myself. It was one governor from a southern state, governor of Arkansas. Governor Clinton invited me way back in 1986 to come and help him set up Grameen program in Arkansas. That's how I came, and Grameen program began in Arkansas. I was just kidding a few minutes back. I said from Pine Bluff to Pine Ridge, it reached from Arkansas. That's why Pine Bluff was the headquarters of the program. So gradually that spread all over the United States. But the current one that we have done is always an explanation. It will not work viably in this country. This is too rich, too expensive. It's impossible. I said, no, that's not impossible. We can try. So in order to try, we just started this year, at the beginning of the year in January, Grameen America, starting in Queens. same Grameen Bank principles, same ideas. We send someone from Bangladesh who have been with Grameen Bank for 25 years, who have been doing it in the rural areas of Grameen, Bangladesh, to come here in New York City to do it. He doesn't know anything about the United States. He does exactly what he did in Bangladesh, same principles, same way. Today we have 375 borrowers, all women. Repayment is 99.3% repayment, and with excellent enthusiasm among the people. And people ask, why did you bring it to New York City? Why not in a rural area, United States? I said, well, it was a deliberate decision for us. We thought about it. We thought New York is the headquarter of the global banking.
It was.
Well, it still is. It's shaky a little bit, but it's still there. So I said, we started it here because while it does banking, New York does banking for the whole world, but it doesn't do banking with their neighbors. So that we can just show them that, look, it's not as worrisome as you think. You can show. So we thought we will show it to them so that they will bring confidence and start doing business to everybody. There are payday loans here where banking system doesn't pay attention to check cashing companies because most millions of people in America cannot open a bank account. So they have to go to the check cashing companies, pay something like 15% of their money to the check cashing companies. So all those kind of things is totally a big gap. Shows a big gap in the financial system. So we thought, if you can demonstrate it here, if it's acceptable, it will be accepted all over the world. So this is what the reason we brought it here. And it works both at the rural areas and the urban areas like New York City. There's no difference. People need money, and you provide them. They needed it, and they can change their life by doing that.
So, Pastor Rick, maybe we need to start a check cashing program in all of our churches in America. Realistically, how do we get the church to become engaged not only in the spirituality of its congregants, but also the economic viability of those same people?
Well, first, thank you for being here. It says more about you than it does about anybody who's a speaker. It says that you're interested in making a difference, and you're interested in what I call the global giants, poverty, disease, illiteracy, trafficking, corruption, all these different issues. You know, sometimes problems are so big, you have to triple team them. You have to tackle them together. And any of these problems, whether it's rural or urban, are going to take a multi-sector approach. It takes the public sector, it takes the private sector, and it takes the faith sector. I call it the three legs of the stool. A one-legged stool will fall over, a two-legged stool will fall over, a three-legged stool will fall over. And one of the things that the faith sector brings to the party is distribution. I could take you to 10 million villages around the world. The only thing in it is a church or a house of worship. There are 600 million Buddhists in the world. There are 800 million Hindus in the world. There are a billion Muslims in the world, and there are 2.3 billion Christians. If we take the people of faith off the agenda, we've ruled out most of the world because most of the world has some faith. And there's already an army ready to be mobilized, an army of compassion, in those villages. They're called churches, or mosques, or temples, or synagogues. And we've been doing this. I have a network of about 400,000 churches in 162 countries. And we've been doing a program called Peace. Promote reconciliation, equip servant leaders, assist the poor, care for the sick, and educate the next generation. And I go back to what Elsie said. We're not interested in simply wealth redistribution. We're interested in wealth creation. And there's no reason at all why those churches can't be involved. In fact, I could give you lots of examples where they are involved in the kind of things that Muhammad is doing and in creating wealth, in creating jobs, in training jobs, and things like that. And I hope we can discuss that.
So like President Clinton, I've had a few years in a political career, and we always had to sell our candidacy. I want each of you now to think of yourselves as a salesman or a saleswoman. You have this audience in front of you. How do we sell the concept and the benefits and the engagement of rural philanthropy? How do you connect with them so that they say, I'm going to invest in a rural area with my philanthropic dollars? Who wants to take that first?
I'll take that first. This may be the last word I get in edgewise, I think. Well, you know, OWISTA has primarily worked in Indian country, and we started this in Pine Ridge in the 1980s, but working with building community development financial institutions. And so President Clinton was responsible for the Community Development Banking Act, which helped CDFIs, community development financial institutions, get started. Nowhere have they been as impactful as on an Indian reservation because credit just was not available. And we've had to look at it very holistically, you know, when we look at it as asset building strategies, financial education, entrepreneurship, home ownership, all of those things. But CDFIs have had to practice safe and sound practices. And so anybody that invests in a CDFI, the money is, I can tell you, I don't know that there's a CDFI that's lost money to an investor yet. And in fact, they've earned a rate of return. Not a lot, but at some. And in the meantime, it's allowed a private sector to start up on some of our reservations, which is just, you know, very key. So,
Mohammed?
Yeah, I just start with expanding the idea of philanthropy itself. Philanthropy kind of traditionally meant by giving away for a good cause. For a good cause, when I give away $1, it goes and achieves the goal, but it never comes back. I said, if we can, within that philanthropy, we can create business, like social business, business to do good, not for making money, just like, unlike the other business. Here, we invest the money to achieve the same goal in a business format. That way, the dollar that we use for that investment, it recycles. So it is endless life rather than one life. So philanthropic money becomes very powerful if you do that. It could be microfinance. If you can lend money to the poor people, they pay you back and it grows and they'll change their life. It could be used as a social business. So microfinance could be an excellent social business. There are many other social businesses. For example, to give a Grameen Bank example, Grameen Bank is owned by the poor people. So you give the ownership to the people at the same time. So he's the largest bank in the country in terms of clients. It's 7.5 million borrowers of Grameen Bank. They own the bank. And they take the loan from the bank with a high repayment rate, they pay it back, and they change their life. Their children go to school, 100% of them children go to school. Grameen Bank gives education loan so the children can pursue higher education. Right now there are over 30,000 students in higher education with Grameen Bank financing. So it's all self-contained. But if anybody could create it with philanthropy money, if not anything else, if they want to invest in social business, we created joint ventures with big multinational companies like Grameen Danone as a social business to bring nutrition to the children of Bangladesh in a business way, not giveaway, not charity way. It's a business. It recovers its cost, but it's not aimed to make somebody rich. It's aimed to achieve a social goal, malnutrition. We have just started a social business, Grameen Veolia, which is a water company. We have a big problem in Bangladesh with drinking water because our water is arsenic contaminated. So literally millions of people drink poison every day. So we are creating as a social business water treatment plants, Veolia quality water for the villagers, very cheap price. You recover your cost, the company continues, recover its cost, and people get the good quality water. So you can go on expanding this. The beauty of social business is once you create one, you can replicate millions of times. It's endless. You don't have to depend on the charity money all the time. You can go to the market, borrow money, do it, and expand. And it's for a cause, not for making anybody rich. So I would say philanthropy has to be reinterpreted, expanded. I'm not saying stop the giveaway money or charity money. The charity has a place. But charity also has to have an expiry date. When I give a charity, it's for the intention of helping people to get out of charity. That has the expiry date. So at the same time, we bring up the ownership to them so that they can own, they can do, change their life. And so enormous creativity out there. We call it rural area. You call it the bottom 3 billion people, bottom 1.5 billion people. This is a treasure. Endless capacity to change their life and change the whole world. the crisis that we have right now because we are going around the same game all over again with the same people. You are not taking care of all the creativity just lying out there. That's what the President Clinton was talking about, the real economy. That's the real economy. You build it in enormous. If all of these 3 billion people can afford one extra shirt, imagine 3 billion shirts that will be produced. But you have to create that purchasing capacity so that they contribute and they create and they become consumers for the products that the world will be producing. You name it, anything, a pair of shoes, 3 billion pairs of shoes. This is a booming economy.
Great. Wangari, you wanted to add something to what he was saying.
Yes, I want. Yes, I wanted to add on the fact that those of us who have been attending the section on climate and energy have obviously seen the great opportunities for investment in carbon, and we are hoping that many people here will find the investments in the carbon market, the emerging carbon market, very attractive. But before we can get there, we will need to get leadership, especially from the United States of America, on avoided deforestation. We want to make sure that a lot of the forests in the world, and especially the tropical forests in the Amazon, in the Congo forest, in the Southeast Asia forest, where we have these huge blocks of forest, we need to protect them from cutting. So we need to encourage governments in that region not to cut their trees. Therefore, we need to invest in the carbon markets where we encourage the governments to keep these forests standing because they are huge carbon sinks. So they are useful not only for the countries where they are, but also for the rest of us if we want to address the issue of global warming. So I would like to encourage not only philanthropy, but also real business investments. But we can't do that in the huge way that we would like to see unless we have leadership from the United States of America, which, as you know, because of its lack of involvement in the Kyoto in a serious way, the Kyoto Protocol didn't do the world a lot of good. It would have been much more useful if the United States had been on board. And we are hoping that this time we'll do whatever we can, including using our votes. I don't have a vote, unfortunately, but I hope those of you who have a vote will use it so that we get leadership that is prepared to provide the leadership that is needed in the world as negotiations are, again, ongoing, and they will culminate in the meeting in Copenhagen in 09, where we really hope that forest will become incorporated. And there is a huge market, especially if the United States became a party to this. We have a huge market where you can invest and therefore put money in governments that are poor, that are trying to address the issues of rural development, but don't have the money. Now, if you invest there, you will not only be protecting the earth, you will not only be making business, but you will also be assisting the planet Earth and the poor people of especially those regions. So I really see this as a great opportunity, and I'm hoping that investors, instead of, as the President was saying, looking inwards and probably putting money under the mattress, that they will go and buy carbon credits.
Pastor Rick, that's as close as you're going to have to a sermon and competition this morning. If you were going to convince everyone listening to all of you to invest in philanthropy in rural areas, what would you tell them?
Well, we're all familiar with the cliche, don't give a person a fish, teach him how to fish. But actually, that's not good enough. We need to do more than teach people how to fish. We need to teach them how to sell a fish. If all you do is teach a person how to fish, you create a village of fishermen, where everybody catches the same fish, they all sit at the same side of the road, sell the same fish, the fish rots and they go home. You get nothing more than an existence economy. What we need is to teach people how to sell a fish. So someone will say, well, I'll make the boats and I'll make the nets. And someone else say, well, I'll can the fish. The other says, well, I'll make the hooks and I'll make the nets. And someone says, I'll be the fish fryer. And someone says, well, I'll do the accounting. And you actually create a market economy. This, I am absolutely convinced, can be done through local churches. We're doing it through local churches all around the world. We have set up microcredit banks through churches. We have worked with many microcredit agencies like Grameen and others, where when someone says, well, the microcredits are available or the microfinancing is available, but then you first have to teach them the principles of saving. One of the great places to teach them things like that is in houses of worship. If I were to make my case, I would put on the screen three little slides. A year ago, I was the closing speaker. President Bush asked me to be the closing speaker for the Global Summit on Malaria. And I said, let me just show you how, whether it's malaria or any other problem in the world, we're not going to solve it without having the mobilization of people at the grassroots. When you talk about grassroots, you talk about people in mosques and churches, in temples and things like that. I said, let me just show you one example of what we're doing. And I threw up a picture, and I said, this is the western province of Rwanda. 700,000 people live in this province. It's totally rural. They have two doctors for 700,000 people. And I said, here are the three hospitals. They're all staffed by volunteers, and it's a 2 days walk to any of these hospitals. Rwanda's a mountainous country, so you have to walk 2 days just to get to the nearest hospital. And that has no indication that you're going to actually get in, even after you get there. So that's not enough healthcare. By the way, two of those hospitals are faith-based and one of them's government, so you wouldn't have two-thirds of it anyway. Then I said, here's the second picture. And I put up a picture and I said, here are the 22 clinics in western Rwanda. Now, it's still a day's walk to any one of these clinics, and if you've been anywhere around the world, you know that a clinic often means a bottle of aspirin on the shelf and that's it. I've been in clinics where there was a microscope and nothing else. So it may be just a closet. But it's a 1 day's walk to any of these clinics. Those 20 of them are church-based, and two of them are government-based. I said, now watch this. And I put up the third slide, and it was covered with dots, black with dots. And I said, now here are the 726 churches. Where would you like to go to get your health care? For that matter, where would you like to go to get your education? Where would you like to go to get your loan? Whatever. I spoke at the Global Summit on AIDS in Mexico this year, and I was told by a Minister of Health of Rwanda, he said that 98% of all Rwandans live within 1 kilometer of a church. That's instant distribution. So somehow we have to figure out how to get business and government and churches to work together.
That's perfect. And Jacques, I'm going to start with you because you're the business mind on this distinguished panel. The title of our panel this morning, or this plenary session, is called...
I'm not in business? Is that what you meant?
I was trying to make him feel good. How's that? Good comeback. Okay, you get to rebut what he says. But he's going to start. Jacques, this title is called The Global Impact of Rural Innovation. How do, you know, one of the great things about philanthropy is we can take risks, we can innovate, we can even fail in ways the public sector and the private sector do not. Give us a good example of rural innovation that can or should be supported by philanthropy.
We've great pleasure. I can rebound from several aspects which have been mentioned. Obviously, Professor Yunus touched on it substantially earlier with regards to the Grameen Bank example and the way it demultiplies. But again, the key underlying principle that we have applied in our case is anything that we do with regards to helping the rural areas is based upon commercial terms. I wouldn't say that we are making big money out of it, but and we don't try to as such, but we have no subsidies as such. It is actually the extreme example of what Professor Yunus was mentioning. It is not based upon philanthropy. It is based upon developing solutions that can be sustainable and demultiply because they are at commercially free market rates. Interestingly enough, they worked on both the issues of climate change sensitive areas that Mrs. Maatai touched on so vividly. With modern technology, which is based upon satellites as well as meteorology data, which are relatively precise nowadays indeed, you can effectively develop, in our case, insurance covers in cooperation with microfinance organizations, which are effectively protecting farmers' communities. In our case, we have developed it in both India and in Africa, Kenya, Mali, Ethiopia, in such a way that full clusters of villages are effectively protected against either variations of temperatures beyond the normal or variations of water precipitations beyond the normal, which are the two major problems which touch their life. And we can, thanks to actually the positive side of capital market developments, in that case weather derivatives, provide solutions which are, in case there is a variance which limits their crops, limits the yield of their crops, and thus would expose them to survival problems and most probably to poverty traps, to actually protect them against that outcome, and thus to make their community viable for the next seasons or for the next planting seasons. So practically, don't forget that in any of the rural areas, in countries like India and Bangladesh would be exactly the same, and most of Africa, the farmer has to basically buy the seeds on credit. That's where actually Grameen Bank comes in and provides them, to a large extent, the ability to buy the seeds. If the yield of a crop is not sufficient, not only they won't have enough to feed themselves and their community, but on top of that, they will be bankrupt. They don't always have Grameen Bank as an extremely socially responsible counterparty to deal with. They very often are still facing absolutely abhorrent rates on the part of their banking systems, as Elsie knows very well. And on the contrary, if we protect the deficiency on the yield thanks to weather-related protections, which we can do pretty easily, effectively, they have the money at the right time to repay the loan and go on to the next stage, and it becomes a virtuous circle. At this stage, we have 500,000 people who are protected, about one-third in clusters of village in Kenya, Ethiopia, and Mali, and the rest in India in different reasons. And it's demultipliable almost to infinity within those communities and those regions, which are exactly where the major problem, as mentioned earlier, does exist.
Great. Mohammed Yunus, fellow businessman, share with us innovation.
That's the point I wanted to make. We have to get out of this mindset that the rich will do the business and the poor will have the charity.
Good point.
It's a continuum. It's a continuum. I gave you the example that the largest bank in terms of clients, Grameen Bank, is owned by the poorest women of Bangladesh. Yeah. It's not buying a chicken or buying a cow, take a $30 loan. They own the bank.
Yeah.
And they get the dividend out of this bank. So they ownership. And then probably you have read it in the newspapers, a big corporate battle going on in Bangladesh on Grameen Phone, which is a cell phone company in the country, largest cell phone company in the country with 30 million plus subscribers, which is 38% owned by Grameen, meaning Grameen borrowers. And our initial contract was they will, after 6 years, give the majority share, sell the majority share to Grameen, which they have not done it, so we continue to fight over it. The idea is the Grameen borrowers will become the owner of the largest cell phone company in the country. So they may be borrowing $30, $50. Collectively, they are big. They can buy the largest company in the country. And that's what the fight is going on. That's what the news is all about. So it's not a small piece. Today, if we are prepared beforehand, you could buy some of the following banks in the United States. No problem. It's possible. So don't ignore them saying, oh, they did $30 loan and so on.
Right.
We led over $1 billion a year in Grameen Bank. 67% of that money comes from the deposit of the borrowers themselves. So when we give a $100 loan to a borrower, $67 out of that $100 is her own money. So it's not a small piece. So you can energize the whole thing. We own the company for solar energy. Today we have 108,000 solar home system installed by that company. And our goal is to reach 1 million solar home system by 2012. If the solar panel cost could a little go down by the technology improvements, if it could be brought down to, say, $2 a watt or $1.50 a watt, every home in Bangladesh will be run by solar home system. I can guarantee you we can do that.
So if we call you a philanthropic businessman.
No, not philanthropic. It's a businessman. That's what, no designation is needed.
Okay.
No objective is
needed. Meet the non-philanthropists on our panel.
It's a business.
Great. Wangari, I want to go back to something you said earlier. You talked about the Millennium Development Goals. Yes, I opened up our remarks by sharing that three-fourths of the world's poor live in rural areas. How do we take the Millennium Development Goals to rural areas around the world? How do we make that happen? We've got between now and 2015 to get the environment and the poverty and the education and the gender equality and the health care. How do we do that?
Well, I certainly don't have a blueprint. Part of what I have heard has been reported at the United Nations says that many countries have not achieved the goals, but that the region of Africa is definitely the one that has not has achieved the least. And the question, therefore, if I had a blueprint, I would apply it first in Africa, but I don't have a blueprint. But I do know that there is not adequate commitment at the policy level to achieve these goals. Because we must invest, for example, we must invest in the protection of the natural resources on which these goals, as I said, if you flip it over, instead of starting with the poverty, start with the environment, protect the soil, protect the forests, and invest in the people, because that's one thing that we keep saying that Africa is not doing enough of, is investing in education, which is about the third goal, I think, it's the second goal, making sure that every primary school child is able to go to school, but that they move on. They can't do very much with the primary education. They have to go to secondary, and they also have to go to tertiary. So I think that governments have a special responsibility to invest in achieving these goals. Yes, they can be assisted, but I really think that if you look at many of the governments that have not achieved these goals, and you compare the resources allocated to different ministries which address these goals, and then compare that to the ministry, for example, of defense, you will find that a lot of money is invested in defense and not in the Minister of Education, or in the Minister of Health, or in the Minister of Environment. So, first and foremost, is governments to commit. Secondly, I think that it is very important for us, especially working at the grassroots level, to invest in initiatives that empower these local people so that they can do what they can do for themselves. And that is what the Green Belt Movement has been trying to do for many years, is to help people manage their natural resources more responsibly, understand how they govern themselves so that they can challenge their leaders, and demand better management of the resources that they have, both within the country and what comes in from friends, so that we can move forward. Now, until we empower the people at the grassroots to do things for themselves, we won't achieve these Millennium Development Goals. Because as has been mentioned by Eunice and also by the pastor, it is very important that people do not rely on giving. I usually, just because the pastor is here, if I may take only 1 minute and say that I usually like the story of Peter and John, Because Peter and John, in chapter 3 of Acts, I think, Pastor, when Peter and John goes to synagogue, they find a beggar, and they tell the beggar, unlike those who had come before, silver and gold we have none, but what we have we will give you. In the name of Jesus of Nazareth, rise up and walk. You, the beggar, rise up and walk. You have to help these people rise up and walk, because you don't want to stay there at the synagogue waiting for handouts. We must empower these communities at grassroots level to rise up and walk.
All right.
I want to say something about that, because you're exactly right. So much of what we do in philanthropic development robs people of dignity, removes initiative, destroys their own economy. It's actually counterproductive. And it is because we don't do what I call starter dough. I grew up in a little village of less than 500 people, and years ago somebody brought over to my mom a little jar of what was, it was a yeast, starter dough for making sourdough pancakes. And every time she wanted to make pancakes, she'd get a bowl and put the flour in it and some water and take that starter dough out and throw it in there and cover it with a cloth, and the next morning it would rise like bread. And before she'd make the pancakes, she'd take a little starter dough out and put it back in the jar. Once that starter dough was given to us, it lasted over 20 years. There's a way to give that sustains, and there's a way to give that makes people dependent. And it is in the way that everything that they're saying here is absolutely correct.
Pastor, I would just like to, if that's okay with you.
Right ahead.
Interrupt.
I mean,
go ahead.
If anybody understands the way to give that creates dependency is on an Indian reservation, because the way our governments were set up by the federal government only did that. They were distributive governments that kept us dependent as a nation. So we've learned those lessons. But at the same time, because Native American tribes, and I'm going back to my first comments, are really under the radar for most folks. And yet there's more there's poor in the United States, and if we can't solve that issue in the United States, how are we going to do it in any other country? And we understand those issues, but one of the largest foundations in this world, who has a new CEO and was getting educated by some of his program officers about the poorest people in the United States are Native American women, he said, so what? And his point was, there's not enough of us. Well, it's poverty's poverty. I don't care if they're 10 people or 10,000 people or 10 million people. And so that's my point for focusing on Indian tribes. So.
We're running out of time, but Mohammed, I want you to have the closing thought.
Yes, sir. Just a quick point. The impression of the message I don't think we want to give as a panel, don't give money for philanthropy. That's not the message. Message is, please do give. But it could be used much more powerfully, most exciting way of using it. That's the point we are making. So let's not confuse that we need to share this wealth, whatever you have, with the $1 trillion in foundations and so on. We have a tremendous opportunity to mobilize the energy of the whole world by using that money. That's the point we are making. Thank you.
You know, one of my favorite quotations that I use often is from an industrialist by the name of J. William Randolph, who started the Cummins diesel engine, and he started the Cummins Foundation. When he started his foundation, he assembled his staff and he gave them this guide to work by. 10 years from now, what will you wish you had done today? I think that's a wonderful guide for all of us in philanthropy, and it's absolutely a wonderful guide for those of us who believe investing in rural areas is truly an investment that produces returns. Thank this panel for their tremendous contributions, and thank you all very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, the plenary session is now concluded. The working sessions will begin at 10:30 this morning. Please proceed to your next session. Thank you so much.